Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, nanoparticles that target cancer cells, using silver to go green in the plastics industry, and extreme science with the use of mass spectrometry out in space and in our most active volcanoes. Plus, the best way to find oil.
What we'd like to do is measure the composition of petroleum sampled from different places within the reservoir. And from looking at differences we observe in the composition, try to understand what has happened to the reservoir in the past or what might be happening to the reservoir now.
Drew Pomerantz will be explaining how his team at Schlumberger set about doing this later in the programme. I'm Mira Senthilingam, and also in this May edition of Chemistry World are Bibiana Campesejo, Mike Brown and Matt Wilkinson.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, youthful meteorites, as a Martian meteorite has been revealed to be a lot younger than we all thought. Is that right, Bibi?
Yes, this meteorite is the oldest Martian rock found on Earth, but it's not as old as originally thought. Scientists had dated it at 4.5 billion years old, but it appears to be only 4.09 billion years old.
And so how do they set about revealing this new age?
Well, it's a collaboration between scientists at the University of Houston and their colleagues at NASA in Houston as well in the US. And while traditionally the age of the meteorite had been calculated by looking at the ratios of long-lived isotopes of samarium and neodymium, now this team of researchers have looked at the measures of lutetium and hafnium.
What about the presence of lutetium and hafnium makes them more reliable as elements to be looking at?
Samarium and neodymium are present in phosphate minerals, which are relatively reactive and therefore can be easily altered by acidic solutions or shock. But lutetium and hafnium are present in minerals that are more resistant to weathering. So the scientists have agreed that that would give a more accurate age for the rock.
So now they've worked out that this meteorite is younger than we previously thought, but what does this mean about finding out more about Mars?
Yeah, they thought this meteorite was part of the primordial crust of Mars, but it was actually formed after a period of very intense volcanic activity. The fact that the meteorite is 4.09 years old and younger than originally thought proves that it formed when Mars was wet and had a very stable magnetic field, which are conditions known to encourage the development of very simple forms of life. And this agrees with the original findings of a group of scientists who in 1996 looked at the rock under the microscope and found what looked like fossilized bacteria. So this new finding seems to support that or confirm that, but the question is very, very difficult to answer. So, but you know, there's some information towards confirming the existence of life.
And now moving away from the red planet and moving to being green here on Earth, as scientists have identified a more eco-friendly way to produce propylene oxide. Now, Mike, what is propylene oxide currently used for?
Well, propylene oxide is a very versatile compound. It's a key intermediate in many industrial processes, such as creating plastics and things, and it can be used in cosmetics, paints, detergents, and even in products for your car like antifreeze. Traditional methods for making propylene oxide have produced harmful byproducts like chlorinated waste and acrolein, which is a simple unsaturated aldehyde, and it's very reactive and toxic to the environment. Other methods that are used also produce carbon dioxide, so these are bad routes to make such a key intermediate, because you obviously have to make a lot of it and you're producing lots of toxic byproducts.
So how have they set about making this more environmentally friendly, and who's been working on it?
So the scientists that have been working on it are a collaboration between the US Department of Energy, the Fritz Haber Institute in Berlin, and the University of Illinois. And they've come up with a new class of nanometer silver catalysts. So they've taken clusters of three silver atoms and reacted them at low temperatures, and they found that propylene oxide has been formed with very few byproducts. So the group have been doing the experimental side of it, and they've also had theoreticians helping them to look at the mechanism involved. And they found that the open shell electron structure of the silver may be behind the reason why it's improved selectivity.
And in what other ways is this more environmentally friendly?
Yeah, this new method doesn't produce carbon dioxide and very low levels of other byproducts like chlorinated waste and acrolein. So the environmental implications are so much better. Similar catalysts, such as gold catalysts, have been studied. And this catalyst, the catalytic cycle, is faster and greater by a factor of 4 than the gold catalysts. So the silver catalyst is actually quicker at producing the propylene oxide, and it's also more environmentally friendly.
So that's quite an improvement. What stage is this at now? Is it early stages? It's just been discovered. So when's it hoped to actually be in use in industry?
At the moment, that's right. It's just on an experimental scale at the moment. But the group are hoping to scale it up to an industrial scale to be used in the future. And hopefully this will have an impact on environmental issues in the future. They also are trying to combine catalysts so that they're bifunctional, which means basically that they can have one catalyst doing two catalytic steps in a particular process. So that's another area of research that they're thinking of. So maybe in the future we can have plastic production with one catalyst that moves all the way from the starting material all the way to the plastic at the end.
Fingers crossed for such a revolution. Thanks, Mike. The analytical technique of mass spectrometry has been in use for over 50 years to determine the elemental composition of chosen samples. It identifies elements by ionising a sample to give charged molecules, the elements within which can then be identified by measuring their mass-to-charge ratios. It's a common technique in chemistry today, but scientists today are constantly pushing its limits to explore more extreme environments. One such scientist is Hunter Waite from the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas, and he designed a mass spectrometer to explore the outer realms of our solar system.
Well, this mass spectrometer was on the Cassini orbiter. It arrived in 2004, and it's been flying around orbiting Saturn, but passing close by many of the icy satellites and moons of Saturn over the course of the mission. As an example, when we fly close through the upper atmosphere of Titan, we find a dense atmosphere. And so it's usually the bringing the instrument or the orbiter in proximity to these moons where we've been making our measurements.
What kind of substances were found then here?
Well, Titan's atmosphere is composed largely of molecular nitrogen with a couple of percent of methane. And the action of solar ultraviolet light on the upper atmosphere, as well as particles from the magnetosphere, electrons and ions, cause reactions in the upper atmosphere, and it's created a very rich organic mixtures, hydrocarbons and nitrile compounds that are much more complex and much higher in density than we ever anticipated. We've seen things that are heavier than molecules such as insulin at those altitudes. So we're creating organic macromolecules 1,000 kilometers above the surface of Titan just due to the interaction of the sun's ultraviolet light with the upper atmosphere of Titan.
So given that this was unexpected then, was the mass spectrometer designed for this able to cope with what was found, or are there now limitations in which future kind of models of this will need to be improved upon in order to accommodate this?
Well, this was an exploratory type mission. We had only designed this mass spectrometer to go up to about 100 Dalton's mass. Many of the molecules were much more complex. If one was to go back, obviously you'd want to go to a higher mass range. In our laboratory, we've been working on new techniques that have much higher mass resolution instrumentation and more sensitive as well. A couple of orders of magnitude more sensitive instrumentation as well as higher mass resolution.
So how would you summarize then, given these findings by Titan of organic compounds, how has this improved the understanding of Saturn's atmosphere?
I think one of the important things is that in the case of Titan, it's a chemistry that's indigenous to Titan itself. It gives us a whole new view of Titan as an abiotic chemical factory in the solar system. It produces organics on the surface that exceed the oil, gas, and coal reserves of the Earth by 10 to 100 times. So it's a very effective organic factory in the outer solar system.
So any potential of shoveling that back to Earth to solve our oil supply problems?
It would not be impossible, but there would have to be a major investment in transportation systems to make it happen.
So maybe not the answer to our energy problems. That was Hunter Waite from the Southwest Research Institute in Texas. And another scientist hot on Hunter's heels is Tim Griffin, chief of the chemical analysis branch at NASA, whose work using mass spectrometers in space has led to their use in another extreme environment, volcanoes.
Yes, we have. We originally used mass spectrometers to help support launch vehicles, to help make sure that we can get vehicles safely into space off the ground. A lot of the gases that we look for on there are the same as what are interested in volcanoes. For this reason, we have adapted our equipment and taken our knowledge about being able to take samples from an area and bring it to a mass spectrometer and be able to push the mass spectrometer to its limits and be able to see things that are difficult to see by any other method.
Now, what kinds of gases would you be looking for in terms of a volcanic eruption or an impending volcanic eruption?
Hydrogen to some extent, but mainly helium, sulfur dioxide, and water and carbon dioxide. The sulfur dioxide, when it gets into the water, turns into sulfuric acid. So that is also another thing that can be looked at. The helium is, they believe, is a real big precursor for how active the volcano is. Helium is created in the magma, Earth's core, and as it becomes closer to eruption time, they see that increase in helium.
And is this the case for all volcanoes, or would this have to be adapted to different types of volcanoes?
Well, there are different types of volcanoes. There are ones that give off more gases than others. The one that just erupted in Iceland had a lot of gas and it was a whole lot of particulate. So the instrumentation does need to be adapted for whatever the particular application is.
What are the current techniques used to try and predict or monitor gases of volcanoes or predict impending eruptions?
The current method for collecting gases are you take an evacuated bottle down into the crater of the volcano and you collect that sample and then you take it back to the lab. Our instrument we actually can take into and do monitor in place so we can get a better tracking of what's going on with the plume and hopefully some over time trend data.
What different methods have you used in order to collect your samples?
We've carried this around in multiple ways. We've put it on multiple aircraft. We put it on the NASA WB-57 aircraft, which is an aircraft that flies up to 50,000 feet at a very slow pace. We've also put it on small personal aircraft, such as Cessna aircraft, and flown it at a very low altitude over volcanoes. We've also put it in the back of cars so we could monitor as we were driving through areas. And we've also hand-carried it on a sling between two people. So it's proven to be a very versatile instrument.
And now, having taken these samples around the volcanoes in Costa Rica, then what were the gases that your spectrometers picked up?
We were able to see a little bit of helium when we carried it in on the ground, and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide were the primary gases that we saw. And we were able to see and characterize pretty well what happens to the plume.
This seems like a very promising technique. So how would it operate in the general field of predicting volcanic eruptions then?
Well, our technique is pretty new in order to be able to make any predictions about the volcanoes. So the whole system would be incorporated into a suite of instruments that would be able to answer all the questions about the volcano, including satellite imaging and satellite instrumentation, to really get a true feel for what's going on. You wouldn't want to do that on every volcano. It would be impossible. So you'd choose your most active or most ones of interest, and you would put this suite of instruments on that. So this would be one part of many instruments that would be used on volcanoes.
So playing its part in the much-needed detection of impending eruptions. That was Tim Griffin from the Chemical Analysis Branch of NASA. This is Chemistry World with me, Meera Senthilingam. Still to come, the chemical way to find the best oil reserves and the use of nanoparticles to target and kill cancer cells. But first, a new form of aromatic molecule mat.
A team of Japanese researchers have managed to incorporate for the first time a lead atom into an aromatic carbon ring. Masachi Saito of Saitama University in Japan took this molecule that contains four carbons and one lead atom and managed to convert it into an aromatic compound. Now, for those of you who don't understand what an aromatic compound is, the most simple example of one is a benzene ring, which contains six atoms of carbon bonded together with alternating single and double carbon-carbon bonds. And what's really interesting about it is rather than the bonds being single and double bonds, in reality they're all the same length, which indicates that the electron density between the double bonds is shared all the way around the ring, and that makes all the bonds much stronger and gives it some very interesting properties compared with a normal single and double carbon bonds.
And now, why up until this point has it been difficult to form an aromatic ring with elements such as lead?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that it hasn't necessarily been tried. But the other thing is that this group has tried it with a lot of steric bulk around the ring. So they all have six carbon rings around them anyway. And on the lead itself, what they've done is it originally had two phenyl groups on there, and they've swapped those for two lithium atoms, or lithium ions, I should say, and that gives the lead a negative charge, which can then be delocalized around the ring. So it's really a case of finding the right system to get this to work.
And now, will this be possible with similar elements?
Well, there are other examples where you can include other elements in these types of rings. I think this is one of the heaviest that's been included so far. And the problem with that is as atoms get bigger, or elements get bigger, their electron shells become more diffuse. So there's less overlap between a really big electron shell from, say, a lead atom with, say, one from carbon than there would be of two carbon atoms where they're the same size. So the problem becomes in having the correct overlap between those orbitals. So you might get bigger atoms being included, but there will eventually become a limit where the sharing of those electrons becomes too small for it to really be count as aromaticity.
Now, having put in this effort to make these aromatic molecules, what are the benefits, or what can be done now that they've made these?
Well, I think in the first case, this really is a chemical curiosity. It's one of those things you really don't see every day. The researchers themselves believe that there may be some applications in catalysis because they do mimic a type of molecule called carbene that has found lots of usage in various different catalytic reactions. But how far this will go is at this stage unknown.
And while moving over to some more biological aspects of chemistry and that sleeping sickness, where a potential oral drug for sleeping sickness could soon be on the horizon, Bibi.
Yes, African sleeping sickness is a neglected disease that affects more than 50,000 people over the world, and if left untreated, it's almost always fatal. So a collaboration between researchers at the University of Dundee and the University of York, both in the UK, have screened more than 60,000 small molecules for a potential lead to try to treat the disease.
Now, what are the limits of current treatments against sleeping sickness?
Well, the treatments at the moment are not very good at all. First of all, they need to be administered by injection. And one of them is a bit of Russian roulette, because one in 20 patients that take melarsoprol are killed. And those that survive have very nasty side effects because it contains arsenic. The other available treatment, eflornithine, requires, although less toxic, several visits to hospital, and you have to have intravenous infusions for a number of hours during a period of 2 weeks. So obviously not something that you will be able to do very easily in the developing world, for example.
So how will this new molecule go about inhibiting the disease?
The researchers have identified a new target protein called NMT, or N-myristoyl transferase, which is found in the parasites that cause the disease, Trypanosoma brucei parasites. NMT is an enzyme that attaches fatty acid chains to about 60 proteins within the parasite. Therefore, it controls the protein's localization, stability, and function. So by attacking NMT, you could potentially impair the growth of the parasite.
That sounds like a very good target indeed. So what stage is it at now? What are the potentials for it to be used as a drug?
They have done in vitro cell culture studies, and they have also done in vivo preclinical studies in mice, and they administered very high doses, but they were cured of the disease within about 3 days. But we are talking about the bloodstream parasite. But with sleeping sickness, you have two stages in the disease. The first one is when the tsetse fly bites the host and releases the parasite into the bloodstream. From that, it moves on to the central nervous system, where it disrupts the host's sleeping patterns and causes dementia, comas, and potentially death. At the moment, the scientists have only been able to attack the parasite while it is in the bloodstream, but not when it is in the CNS. There's obviously the issue of getting the drug through the blood-brain barrier, of course.
And so is that potentially what this molecule could hopefully do?
They will continue to do studies, and also they will be looking at the toxicity and also the potential for the parasite developing resistance.
Thank you, Bibi. Oil. As much as we're trying globally to wean ourselves off it, we still need it. A lot. And demands are fast outweighing the supply. So how can scientists set about exploring our reserves to find the best sources of oil, and also the best way to extract it without changing its composition? Well, one person whose job it is to come up with this is Drew Pomerantz, research scientist at oilfield service company Schlumberger.
So petroleum is one of the most complex naturally occurring mixtures, and it's our job to try to understand what is the composition of petroleum and to use that information to figure out where in a reservoir oil might be located, how much oil might be there, and what would be the most efficient way to get that oil out of the ground.
So what are the components of petroleum that you look into, and how do you look into them?
The most abundant component in petroleum is usually alkanes. But in terms of finding oil and figuring out how to produce it, you need to think not only about the composition of oil, but its function. So, for example, oil has some resistance to flow, some viscosity. It has some propensity to separate into different phases. For example, if a solid phase separates out, that is likely to clog up your flow lines, or even worse, clog up the pore space in your reservoir rocks. That makes it really difficult to get the oil out of the ground. To understand things like viscosity and what people refer to as flow assurance, as breaking into phases, now you have to look at more than just the most abundant components of the oil. For example, it is the highest molecular weight, or the highest boiling point components of oil, referred to as asphaltenes. This is the same thing that you make roads out of and that you make roofing tar out of. It's found in petroleum. And that fraction really contributes to the viscosity of the oil, and it really contributes to the propensity of the oil to separate out asphaltene-rich solid phase that could clog your pipes or clog your rocks.
So essentially you want to try and find the places or the sources of oil that wouldn't have that present.
Exactly. Or figure out what you can do to remediate it. For example, as people begin looking in deeper and deeper waters to produce oil, one of the things they encounter is that they now have to pipe their oil through relatively cold waters in order to go from the reservoir to the shore. At those temperatures, there can be waxes that precipitate out. And one of the things we'd like to know is, first of all, can we predict the wax onset temperature when this problem will occur? Then can we come up with the most economic way to remediate it against it? That could be heating the pipes, or it could be adding a diluent or some sort of solvent to the crude oil that would better stabilize the waxes.
Now, as well as temperature, what other factors can play a role in changing the composition of the oil?
When oil is produced from the ground to the surface, the two main changes that occur are the temperature drops and the pressure drops. And each of those can cause a problem. For example, you could imagine that there are some components that are in the gas phase at the high temperature reservoir, but they condense when you drop the temperature when you produce the oil. At the same time, you could imagine there are some components that are in the liquid phase when the oil is in high pressure in the reservoir, but they volatilize when you drop the pressure to go to the surface. So changes can occur both ways, in liquids going to gases, gases going to liquids, or supercritical fluids going to either. You must understand which of these processes will occur in order to figure out the most efficient way to capture the oil. The plumbing that you put on the surface is going to be different based on whether you expect to produce mainly gas or you expect to produce mainly liquid.
So your role is to find out where now you can extract and how you could extract oil from the ground then. So how would you target the places that you could feasibly extract oil or petroleum?
One thing that the industry is really now only beginning to appreciate is that even within a particular reservoir, the composition of petroleum can vary greatly. Oil, being a complex mixture of many components, will naturally settle out into different compositions at different places in the reservoir. A typical example is the relatively light components of the petroleum, for example, methane, ethane. Being low density, they rise to the top. They're concentrated near the top of the reservoir. On the other hand, the high dense components like asphaltenes are found concentrated near the bottom of the reservoir. A reservoir may even today be actively charged or actively filled with oil or gas, or the oil that's in there may be actively being altered by the presence of bacteria. So if you have all of these processes that potentially could be going on, what we'd like to do is measure the composition of petroleum sampled from different places within the reservoir. And from looking at differences we observe in the composition, try to understand what has happened to the reservoir in the past or what might be happening to the reservoir now. The better we can understand the reservoir, the more efficiently we can produce the oil. One of the causes that is becoming to be seen as quite important is the question of whether or not an oil reservoir consists of one connected flow unit. You could imagine an oil reservoir could look like a sponge where you have a series of pores that are full with fluid. And if you put a straw into a sponge and start sucking on the straw, you'll eventually get all the water to flow through the pore space and up through the straw. That's a very nice situation. Another example would be a piece of bubble paper. If you puncture one of the bubbles with your straw, you'll get all the air out of that one, but you won't get the air out of the remaining bubbles. The same thing can happen in oil reservoirs. By measuring the composition of petroleum, we can potentially gain some information as to whether the reservoir consists of one flow unit or many disconnected flow units. And that has a big influence in estimating the total economics of the project.
Drew Pomerantz, research scientist at Schlumberger. Now, to a finding that could hopefully solve the much-debated health problems or concerns of carbon nanotubes. Is that right, Mike?
Yes, that's right. So carbon nanotubes are very versatile materials. They can be used in gas storage, catalysis and electronics, but little is known about how they degrade, and especially in the body, so whether they're biodegradable. Previous thinking has been that carbon nanotubes are very similar to asbestos, so they've got very long fibres which can't be broken down by macrophages, which are immune cells in our body. Previous studies have shown in mice that when carbon nanotubes are inhaled, they cause inflammation in the lungs, and this could lead to disease or cancer in the future. It has been thought that strong oxidants are needed to break down carbon nanotubes, such as like hydrogen peroxide, so they've been thought not to be very good for bioapplications like delivering medicine and things like that.
So now, though, scientists have found out that our immune system might actually be capable of attacking the nanotubes.
Yes, that's right. Scientists led by a team at the University of Pittsburgh have found that an enzyme, myeloperoxidase, which is present in neutrophils, which are human immune cells, break down the nanotubes before inflammation can occur. The enzyme uses hydrogen peroxide and converts it to hyperchlorite and reactive radicals that usually break down invading bacteria in the body. This degrades the nanotubes and produces carbon dioxide, and the degradation products aren't harmful to a human.
On what scale has this been experimented so far?
At present, this is just a model, so no human tests have been carried out. They've used short nanotubes with the enzyme and hydrogen peroxide, which suggests that in the future the nanotubes could be used for drug delivery. But at the moment, they don't know what effect it will have on living lung cells. And there are also questions about exposure limits for the nanotubes in the body as well. So it's at a very early stage, but it is looking promising.
And staying on the nanoscale now, with nanoparticle drugs to defeat cancer cells, and this is using RNA interference, Matt.
Yes, indeed, Mira. So just to explain for those people that haven't heard about RNA interference before, RNA, or ribonucleic acids, are transcribed from DNA and are used to modulate protein synthesis. So by using these small chains of RNA, which are often known as short interfering RNAs or gene silencing RNAs, they can modulate the synthesis of the various proteins, which can then lead to various disease states and cancer.
And why has this been difficult to date to use these?
Well, the thing about RNA is that it's actually metabolized quite quickly, so they disappear out the body, and if they avoid the natural degradation that happens in the blood, then they get excreted very quickly. So the key is to actually deliver the RNA to the cells that you want the RNA to interact with, and to stop whatever disease process is going on there. Now, Mark Davis at the California Institute of Technology has been working on this project for the last 15 years or so to try and actually get RNA to where he wants it to be. And what he's done is he's self-assembled a cyclodextrin-based polymer with the siRNA molecules, and then that forms a core of a nanoparticle. He's then coated that with polyethylene glycol, which is used to protect many biological drugs in the body. And this stops the nanoparticles themselves from clumping together, which would then make them dangerous to put into the body. And then on the surface of that, he's actually added the protein transferrin, which can then actually be used to help target those nanoparticles into various cells.
So all of this combines together, and how does it actually then go in and find its target cells?
Well, the transferrin actually homes in on the excessive transferrin receptors that are often found on the surface of cancer cells. So they really bind very strongly to cancer cells, so they ignore most of the other cells in the body. And then once they're in there, the nanoparticle opens up, releases its payload of siRNA, which can then go in and stop the cells from producing the various proteins that it needs to survive, essentially killing them.
And what type of cancer has this been looked into with so far?
Well, the first stage was actually a melanoma or skin cancer. But the applications for this are quite wide-ranging. And what's really exciting is this is the first study that's ever shown this gene silencing technique to work in the body. I mean, it's really quite amazing.
So what would the next steps be then to try and actually get this in the clinic and in use in cancer patients?
Well, this is already in the clinic. I mean, this has been done in phase one trials and been shown to be very, very successful. Obviously, getting a drug to market takes a long time and a lot of money, so they're going to need backing and probably 5 to 10 years of actually clinical development to actually show that to prove that it's not only safe but and effective, but that it's tolerated by a wide range of people.
Thanks, Matt. Now that's nearly all we have time for this month, but to leave you with a smile on your face, possibly a forced smile, here's the Chemistry World Joke of the Month. So who sent us in this month's delight, Matt?
Okay, so this month's joke was sent in by Charity Wilson Hansbury from Euless in Texas, and the joke is, why do chemists call helium, curium and barium the medical elements? And the answer is, because if you can't helium or curium, you bury them.
Okay, well, that's better than some of the other jokes have been. But if people think that they can even trump that, what do they have to do, Matt?
Well, all they have to do is send their name, address and obviously the joke to chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And if you're currently cringing, but also want to prove that chemistry can provide a good basis for a joke, the email address to send in your jokes is, again, chemistryworld@rsc.org. And you may even get your hands on a Chemistry World goodie bag. Now, your regular presenter, Chris Smith, will be back with more chemical delights next month. But don't forget, there's also our sister podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, to keep you entertained in the meantime. Contributors this month were Bibiana Campasejo, Mike Brown and Matt Wilkinson. I'm Mira Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.